Anuruddha, master of the divine eye, taken from the lives of the disciples. Friday, October the 13th, 2006.
Wow.
Friday the 13th?
Yes, it
is. And this is coming from the Wheel publication number 362.
This is kind of a fun thing. It has some stories in it of Anuruddha, and Anuruddha is really one of my favorite arahats during the time of the Buddha. He was brilliant in a lot of ways. His wisdom was very strong. It wasn't quite as strong as Sariputta's, but it was still right up there. And a lot of people would come to him, and they would ask him how he meditated and that sort of thing. But Anuruddha was Ananda's older brother. So that's another thing that I kind of liked about this. Okay, this is Anuruddha, master of the divine eye, early life and ordination. The Buddha's father, King Subhadana, had a brother, a prince, Amitodama, who had five children. Among them was Ananda, who was later to be the Buddha's faithful attendant, and Mahanama, heir to the Sakyan throne. A third brother was Anuruddha. Anuruddha briefly dwells on his youth. When I was born within the Sakyan clan, as Anuruddha known, by dance and song, attended by clang and cymbals, wait. From this we gather that during his youth in the Sakyan capital of Kapilavastu, in the foothills of the Himalayas, he lived amongst the luxuries of an Indian prince, in the company of dancers, actors, and artists. Thus he passed his time in joyful pursuit of fleeting pleasures. Enhanced with life, he gave little thought to the meaning and purpose of existence, though the ancient hymns and myths which he must have heard did moot these questions. There came, however, a day when there was a turning point of his life. His brother Mahanama had been thinking about the fact that many of the Sakyan clan had joined the Sangha, the Buddhist order of monks, while so far none had done so from his own family. Though there were four vigorous young brothers, Mahanama, however, did not have a strong enough urge and initiative to take that step himself, and thus set an example for the others. Rather, he went to his brother Anuruddha and told him about his thoughts. He ended by saying that either he or Anuruddha should leave home and join the Buddha and his Sangha. At first, Anuruddha was not at all ready to leave his brother's decision, to have his brother's decision thrust upon him. He replied that he felt himself to be too delicate physically to withstand the rigors of an ascetic life. They got carried around a lot and pampered with nothing but the best foods, and they were continually attended on. Kind of like what happens when you become a monk. Yeah, I get pampered all the time. I can, you know. Mahanama then vividly described to him the burden of the householder's life that he would have to shoulder. There was the plowing to be done, and planting, watering, digging, taking care of crops, harvesting and managing and all that year in and out, year in and year out. And Aruda said that this was all right, since all that hard work served a purpose, namely to be able to enjoy the pleasures of the five senses. Yet he admitted this work left one with hardly any time for enjoyment. Mahanama agreed, many are the fetters that bind one to the duty endlessly. Their father and their grandfather had done the same, and they themselves would have to lead the same kind of life. This thought of endless cycles of rebirth into life of never-ending toil took hold of Aniruddha's mind. Again and again he saw himself bound to life and struggled and die in an endless round. When he saw this, his present life appeared to him stale and devoid of meaning. So he decided to follow the Buddha and try to break through the cycles of continuous becoming. Immediately he went to his mother and asked her for permission to become a monk, but she refused. As she was not willing to be separated from even one of her sons. But when Aniruddha repeatedly entreated her, she told him that if his friend, Prince Bhadya, viceroy and successor to the Sakyan throne, would be willing to enter the order, then she would give him her permission. She may have thought that Bhadya would not wish to give up his chance to become the next king, and that Aniruddha would then not choose to part from his friend. Aniruddha next went to Bhadya and told him that his ordination depended on Bhadya's joining him. Bhadya said, whether it depends on me or not, there should be ordination. I with you. There he stopped in the middle of the sentence. He had wanted to say, I shall come with you, but he felt regret. His wish for worldly power and enjoyment overtook him, and he said, go and be ordained according to your wish. But Aniruddha asked him again and again, come, friend, let us both go forth into the homeless life of a monk. Then Bhadya saw the sadness in his friend's face. He softened and said that after 7 years from now, he would be ready. Aniruddha replied that this was too long to wait. And by his repeated entries, Bhadya reduced the time step by step to 7 days. He would need at least this time to settle his worldly affairs and install his successor. He was true to his word, and so Aniruddha was free to go with him. This decision naturally caused much disturbance in the royal family, for Aniruddha's example led other princes, too, to follow the great son of the Sakyas and join the Buddha's fraternity of monks. So one day, 6 Sakyan princes, together with Upali, the court barber, and an armed escort, set out from their homes intending to enter the Sangha. They were the Sakyans Bhadya and Aruda, Ananda, Bhagu, and Devadatta. To avoid arousing suspicion over the purpose of their departure, they left as if on their usual outing to pleasure gardens. Having gone a long distance, then they sent the escort back and entered the neighboring principality. There they took off their ornaments, tied them in a bundle, and gave that to Upali, saying, there is enough for your livelihood. Now return home. But the Barbarupali, while already on his way back, stopped and thought, "The Sakyans are fierce people. They will think that I have murdered the princes, and they will kill me." He hung the bundle on a tree and hurried back to join the princes. He told them of his fears and said, "If you, O princes, are going forth into the homeless life of monkhood, why should I not do the same?" The young Sakyans, too, thought Upali was right in not going back and allowed him to join them on the way to see the Blessed One. Having arrived where the Master dwelt, they asked him for ordination and added, "We Sakyans are proud people, O Lord. Here is Upali, the barber, who had attended on us for a long time. Please, Lord, give him ordination first, so he will then be senior, our senior, and we shall have to salute him and do duties proper for his seniority. Thus will the Sakyans' pride be humbled in us." The Buddha did as requested, and thus these seven received ordination with Upali the first. Upali became the arahat that was foremost in the rules of the discipline. And Upali was so good at that, that after the Buddha died in the first Buddha's council, Ananda answered all the questions about the suttas. And Upali answered all the questions about the Vinaya. Within 1 year, most of them had achieved some spiritual attainment. Bhatia was the first to attain arahatship, as one liberated by wisdom and endowed with the three knowledges. The three knowledges are the tivijja, that's remembering your past lifetime, seeing the arising, passing away of beings, or seeing the passing away and arising of beings, and dependent origination. Okay, three knowledges. Anuruddha attained the divine eye, Ananda to the fruit of stream entry. I think this is a mistake. He didn't have the fruit of stream entry, he had the path of stream entry. And Devadatta to ordinary, mundane, supernormal powers. I mean, he could only fly in the air and read other people's minds and manifest stuff. And only mundane, supernormal powers. Bhagu, Kimbala, and Upali became arahats later, as did Ananda and Anuruddha. But Devadatta's reckless ambition and misdeeds led him to hell. Among those who were preeminent in a particular skill was the Venerable Anuruddha, who was praised by the Buddha as being foremost in developing the divine eye. Once, when a number of eminent monks were living together in the Gosinga forest, the question arose among them as to which kind of monk could lend brilliance to that forest. Anuruddha replied that it was one who, with a divine eye, could survey 1,000 world systems. Just as a man standing on a high tower could see 1,000 farmsteads. On another occasion, Anuruddha said that it was through his cultivating the four foundations of mindfulness that he obtained the divine eye. Now, this leads to some real interesting things, because the Vipassana people take the Satipatthana Sutta as being their personal realm. But in order to attain a divine eye, you have to get into the fourth jhana. And then you start directing your mind towards, towards past lives and that sort of thing. But because of his past good actions, when somebody is sensitive to feeling, there can be the spontaneous arising of some psychic abilities, like the divine eye or the divine ear or flying in the air or reading other people's minds like that. It can happen spontaneously. So with his cultivating the four foundations of mindfulness, he got into the fourth jhana, which has the equanimity. Now, I've been asked by people if I would teach them how to remember past lifetimes. And I won't teach anybody about past lifetimes until they have gotten and have some degree of control in the fourth jhana, because you need the equanimity. Because some of the things we've done have been real good. Some of the things we've done have not been so good. And having those memories can really be shocking, seeing those kind of things. So it's a necessary thing to have the fourth jhana. These people that are doing hypnosis and fooling around with past lifetimes, it's really dangerous. It can cause mental imbalance that's just unbelievable, because they start realizing that what they did.
I read a book that was really interesting about a guy who was doing the mental hypnosis of regressive people. But his curiosity was not the past lives, but what the beings did in between the lives.
Well, if you go by Abhidhamma, you go from one lifetime to the next in just a one thought moment. You can be reborn in any... There doesn't have to be a break. Let's put it this way. There doesn't have to be a break of being a human being and then being reborn as a human being in your next lifetime. There doesn't have to be any period in between there, except when there's this 4 months or 5 months before your consciousness starts to get strong enough to, but still the consciousness is there from one thought moment in one body to the thought moment in the next body. I know this is different than the Tibetan Book of the Dead and the Egyptian Book of the Dead, but it seems to be that way. Like there's dying from this realm and having a spontaneous birth in a heavenly realm. You're born with an adult body, and you're in the heavenly realm. There's no time period in between the dying from one time to being reborn into another. So I don't know, but I do know that has happened enough with other people that have died, monks and such, that they get reborn immediately in another realm. There's no pause between the death here and the spontaneous rebirth in another realm. And I guess you can say it kind of depends on the person's merit. There was a lady, she was a princess, no, she was a queen. And she had sexual activity with a dog. And the king was up in a tower and he saw her having that. And she came back, he came and talked with her about it. And she said, oh, it's just because this is an optical illusion. Now you go down and you stand where you saw me and I'll go up there. And she went up to the same window and she yelled down to the king, King, how can you be having sex with a goat? And by perpetuating this lie, she was extremely, extremely devoted to the Buddha. And she supported the Buddha very much. Now, when she died, she was reborn in a hell realm for perpetuating that lie. And right after she died, the king went to the Buddha and he was going to ask where she was reborn because her faith was so strong and she practiced so much generosity and all of this. And the Buddha used his psychic ability to make him forget. Now this happened every day for 7 days. He'd go see the Buddha with the purpose of finding out where she was reborn. And the Buddha saw that if the king was told that she was reborn in a hell realm, that he would have lost a lot of confidence in the Buddha and it would have been all kinds of problems for him. So after the 7th day, she died from that realm and she was reborn in the heavenly realm. And the king went to ask the Buddha where she was reborn and the Buddha said, oh, she's in the heavenly realm. Malika, that's right. So those how do you what is it comes down to what is time. And for some people the time from one part of one thought moment to the start of another thought moment, there might be a gap of time there. And that might be what he was seeing, or maybe not. As I said, I just don't know. I don't know how to answer that. Well, it's like Queen Malika. I mean, she was very devoted, very virtuous, except for this one time, and she had a guilty feeling. When she died, she thought of that and was reborn in a hell realm. But she only stayed there for a very short period of time. Talking about karma can make you crazy. So it's all speculation until you get there to see it for yourself. Come around and if you die before I do, come around and tell me. What more can I say? He also helped his own pupils to attain the opening of the divine eye. His verses related his experience. The fivefold concentration wrapped, mind in peace and unified, inner tranquility I gained, and thus was purified, my divine eye. So right here he's telling you, I cultivated this practice by the four foundations, and the next verse is talking about, in Abhidhamma, they say that there's a difference between vitakka jhana and vichara jhana. So they take the first jhana and split it into two. That's why they call it five jhana. Yeah. The fivefold jhana, standing firm, I knew the passing and rebirth of beings. Their coming and their going I perceived, their life in this world and beyond. The divine eye is the ability to see beyond the range of the physical eye, extending in Anuruddha's case to a thousandfold world system, which may perhaps be identified with a galaxy in the modern astronomy. You remember Tangkulu Sayadaw? He was said to have all kinds of psychic abilities. And I was in a room one time, and somebody asked him directly, is there life on other planets? And his answer was, yes, I've seen it. I loved that. That was great. This faculty can be obtained by one who has reached the fourth meditative absorption. We'll take that out and say the fourth samatha vipassana jhana, and takes this meditation as the base for further development as described. I'll take that out and not even mention it. It says of the Visuddhimagga. The divine eye is a mundane, of a mundane character. It can be obtained by an unliberated worldling, a patujana, as well as by those on the four stages of emancipation. Anuruddha attained it before he became an arahat. Makes sense. The Buddha himself used this faculty during his daily routine, when in the early morning he would survey the world of beings who would be helped by the Dhamma. Through his divine eye, he also saw when one of his disciples experienced difficulties in progress on the path. Seeing this, he often went to that disciple to give him advice and encouragement. As one of the three higher knowledges, the divine eye has the name and function of the knowledge of the passing away and reappearing of beings. Now, the Buddha, when he would survey the world and he would see a disciple that had some kind of problem, he would disappear from where he was and show up, materialize right in front of the guy. So, out of respect, all of the monks always had a seat and water for washing made ready. So they'd be sitting in the forest and they have their spot, and then they'd put a piece of cloth down that was clean and some water and that sort of thing in case the Buddha showed up. Fun stuff. Having acquired the faculty of the divine eye, the Venerable Anuruddha made use of his meditative skill to further his progress towards arahatship. But before reaching that height, he had to face many a battle within his mind. Three reports tell of it. Once the venerable Anuruddha lived in the eastern bamboo grove together with his cousin Nandiya and the Sakyan noble Kimbala. These three monks were so mature in their practice of the teaching that each of them could live alone for himself, devoted to the spiritual practice. Only every fifth night would they meet to discuss Dhamma. Undisturbed by things or people, the harmony existing between these three forest hermits has become legendary and stands in sharp contrast to the quarrelsome monks of Kosambi. When the Buddha visited the three monks, he asked Anuruddha how it was that he'd lived in peace and harmony with his two companions. Anuruddha replied, "In deeds, words, and thoughts, I maintain loving kindness towards these venerable ones. In public and in private thinking, why should I not set aside what I am minded to do and do only what they are minded to do? And I act accordingly. We are different in body, venerable sir, but only one in mind." After the Buddha had inquired about their life and concord, he asked Anuruddha whether they had gained any spiritual attainment transcending average human capacity. Then Anuruddha told of a difficulty that he had experienced in a very sublime meditation they had practiced. They had perceived an inner, now this said light, but it's actually radiance, and had a vision of sublime forms, but that radiance and vision of forms disappeared very soon, and they could not understand the reason. The Buddha explained that one who wanted to experience these subtle states of mind and in full and have steady perception of them should free himself from the 11 imperfections, upakalesa. Now this is one of the things that Buddha Gosa did, is he took these upakalesa and he made up a lot of them and put them in the Visuddhimagga when he was talking about the mindfulness, the vipassana. And he put them that these arise after the fourth insight knowledge. These can arise after the fourth insight knowledge. But he took them directly from this sutta. The first uncertainty about the reality of these phenomena and the significance of the inner light, which might easily be taken as sensory illusion. The second imperfection is inattention. One no longer directs his full attention to the inner radiance, but regards it as something unremarkable or inessential, and thus dismisses it as unimportant. The third imperfection is lethargy and drowsiness. The fourth, anxiety and fright, which occurs when threatening images and thoughts arise from the subconscious regions of mind. When these imperfections have been mastered, elation may arise, which excites body and mind. Such exaltation is often a habitual reaction to any kind of success. When that elation has exhausted itself, one may feel drained of that happy emotion and fall into inertia, a heavy passivity of mind. To overcome it, one makes a very strong effort, which may result in the excess of energy. On becoming aware of that excess, one relaxes and, in a repeated alternation of extremes, falls into sluggish energy. In such a condition, then, mindfulness is weak. Strong longing may arise for desirable objects of the celestial or the human world. According to the focusing of the inner light, which had been widened in its range, this longing will reach out to a great variety of objects and thus lead to another imperfection, a large diversity of perceptions. This description is not necessarily the one that is talking about in that sutta. I'd have to go through the sutta to show you the differences. Be it on the celestial or the human plane, having become dissatisfied with that great diversity of forms, one chooses to contemplate one of them, be it of a desirable or undesirable nature. Concentrating intensely on the chosen object will lead to the 11th imperfection, the excess of meditating on these forms. Addressing Anuruddha and his two companions, the Buddha thus described vividly for his own experience the 11 imperfections that may arise in the meditative perceptions of pure forms, and he explained how to overcome these problems. When Anuruddha had perfected himself more and more in the jhanas and in those refined meditative perceptions, he one day went to see the Venerable Sariputta and said, "Brother Sariputta, with a divine eye which is clarified and supernormal, I am able to perceive a thousandfold world system. My energy is strong and inflexible. My mindfulness is alert and unconfused. My mind is calmed and unexcited. My mind is collected and unified. Yet my mind is still not freed without clinging from the defiling taints." Thereupon Sariputta replied, "When you think, Brother Anuruddha, that my divine..." Now this is Sariputta. He doesn't know anything about the divine eye except the wisdom of how dependent origination works. That's where he's getting this information. "When you think, Brother Anuruddha, that with your divine eye you can perceive a thousandfold world system, that is self-conceit in you. When you think of your strenuous energy, your alert mindfulness, and your calmed body, and your concentrated mind, that is agitation in you." Why is that agitation? Because that's restless. That's restlessness thinking. I'm thinking and observing this. This is how this is happening. "When you think that your mind is still not liberated from the cankers that makes for scruples in you, impatience, it will be good if the Reverend Anuruddha would discard these three things and would not pay attention to them, and would instead direct his mind towards the deathless element, Nibbana." Now this is tricky, because he's talking about both kinds of Nibbana. He's talking about mundane and super mundane. Every time you relax, when that craving arises, that's a mundane. And eventually that leads to the super mundane. Having heard Sariputta's advice, Anuruddha again resorted to solitude and earnestly applied himself to the removal of those three obstructions within his mind. On another occasion, Anuruddha lived in the country of the Chetia people, in the eastern bamboo grove, that it occurred to him in his contemplation, there are seven thoughts that should be cherished by a truly great man. Namely, that the Buddha's teaching will suit only one who is frugal, contented, bent on seclusion, energetic mindfulness, collected and wise, and that it will not suit one who lacks these qualities. You remember at Bhavana when each one of the monks had a topic that we gave during one retreat? I had contented. What a great, that was really good. Contented means happy. So that's right down my alley, boy, I'll tell you. When the Buddha perceived in his mind the thoughts of his cousin and pupil, he appeared before Anuruddha and approved of his thoughts thus, "Good, Anuruddha, good. You have well considered seven thoughts of a great man. You may now also consider this eighth thought of a great man. This teaching is only for one who inclines to the non-diffused. This teaching is not for one who inclines to worldly diffuseness and delights in it. There are times when your mind grasps something while you're meditating, and you can start reflecting on how it works. And that's what he was basically doing. This is still part of the meditation. As long as you don't indulge in it and have repeat thoughts about it. One time I was sitting, I'd been sitting for a couple of months, and I started watching very closely the five aggregates. And I started noticing that the five aggregates and the four foundations of mindfulness are really the same thing. And I thought through in all the instances that I'd seen the five aggregates arise. And it really was true. And I was reflecting on that, and there was a big release because of that understanding, and it was quite nice. So these kind of things can arise. It's just that you don't indulge in the thinking about it. And your mind can become diffused. It can become a little bit scattered if you overdo the thinking of what's happening with your meditation, whatever that insight happens to be. And then your mind will start to go and start thinking about, oh, I gotta go tell this person, and I gotta tell that person, and that's how your mind turns towards the worldly diffused or diffused mind, and you start delighting in thinking about how everybody is going to be so happy to have this insight and all of these kind of things. That's one of the dangers about this kind of thinking. So when the Buddha came to Anuruddha and he told him, this teaching is for one who inclines to the non-diffused, what he was basically saying is, you're thinking too much about this, let it go. And just get back to relaxing and letting go of the craving whenever it arises. The Buddha said that when Anuruddha contemplated these eight thoughts, he will be able to attain at will the four meditative jhanas. He would then no longer be affected by worldly things, but would regard the four simple requisites of a monk. In the same way as a layman would enjoy his luxuries, these requisites would make his mind joyous and unperturbed, and thus be helpful to his attainment of Nibbana. In parting, the Buddha advised Anuruddha to stay at the eastern bamboo grove. The venerable Anuruddha did so, spending the rain's retreat there. It was during this time that he attained the consummation of his striving. He attained arahatship, which is the state of Nibbana during life. At the hour of his attainment, he uttered the following verse: "He knew my heart's intent, the Master. He whose peer the world has not, he came to me by mystic power with body wrought by mind. To me, when further truths I wish to learn, the Buddha the last truth revealed. He who delights in freedoms from diffuseness, that freedom from diffuseness taught to me, and I who heard the blessed Dhamma dwelt constantly intent to keep his rule. The three wisdoms have I made my own, and all the Buddha's ordinance is done." Now, the three wisdoms, again, this is a meditation that an awful lot of monks practiced, was seeing past life, seeing arising, passing away of being, seeing dependent origination. The Venerable Anuruddha's spiritual path is marked from two prominent features. First, his mastery of the divine eye and other supernormal faculties. And second, his cultivation of the four foundations of mindfulness. He often stressed the wide-ranging potency of an arduous practice of mindfulness. Frequently, the Venerable Anuruddha was asked how he gained proficiency in the great direct knowledges, which includes the five mundane supernormal types of knowledge as sixth arahatship. He always replied that it was through the constant practice of the four foundations of mindfulness, mentioning in particular the supernormal powers. And his recollection of former lives extended to 1,000 eons. That's expansions and contractions of the universe. Good memory. What? He also said that Satipatthana enabled him to gain that perfect control of emotive reactions, called the power of noble ones, by which one can regard the repulsive as non-repulsive, and the non-repulsive as repulsive, and view both with equanimity. He further stresses the importance of that practice by saying that whoever neglects it is also neglecting the Noble Eightfold Path, and that his fourfold mindfulness leads to the end of craving. Just as the river Ganges would not deviate from its course to the ocean, in the same manner a monk who practices the four foundations of mindfulness could not be deflected from his life as a monk and made to return to the worldly life. Once, when Anuruddha was ill, he surprised the monks by his equanimity in bearing pain. They asked him how he was able to bear up as he did, and he replied that his composure was due to his practice of the fourfold mindfulness. Another time, the Venerable Sariputta came to Anuruddha in the evening and asked him what he now regularly practiced, so that his facial expression was always one of happiness and serenity. Anuruddha again said that he spent the time in the regular practice of the four foundations of mindfulness, and that this was the way in which arahats live and practice. The Venerable Sariputta thereupon expressed his joy at having heard Anuruddha declare his attainment in such a way. Once, when he questioned by Sariputta and Mahamoggallana about the difference between those who are still in training towards arahatship and an arahat who is beyond training, he said that they differ in the practice of the fourfold mindfulness. While the former accomplishes it only partly, the latter does so completely and perfectly. Anuruddha also professed to possess those lofty qualities called the 10 powers of the Tathagata. Though, as the commentary marks, he possessed them only in part and to a lesser degree than the Buddha. While amongst Anuruddha's talk cited so far dwelt with topics of meditation, there are also quite a number of texts concerning women with Anuruddha. Concerning women whom Anuruddha had met. There is, for instance, a text in which one of the following incidents is told. Once, when Anuruddha lived alone in the forest, a female deity of the realm of the 33, Jalini by name, appeared before him. Anuruddha's previous existence, when he was Asaka, the ruler of the celestial realm of the 33 gods, where she lived, she had been his wife and chief queen. Out of her old attachment to him, she longed to be reunited with him in that heavenly world where they would have lived together. So she urged him now to aspire to rebirth into that world. But Anuruddha replied, "On bad course truly are those celestial maidens who in attachment cling to selfhood and desire. On bad course likewise are those beings who would be husbands of those celestial maidens." But that deity had no understanding of the words and ideas such as they were, and thus she replied, "They do not know of happiness who have not seen the joyous pleasurances, which is the mighty God's abode, the glorious gods of the 33. Anuruddha said, "You do not understand, O fool. The words declared by arahats, impermanent are all conditioned things, subject to rising and decay. Having arisen, they will disappear. Their ceasing is happiness. No longer shall I dwell, O Jalini, in deities' realms. For me, rebirth has come to an end." Take that. On another occasion, many female deities called the Graceful Ones appear before him, and having saluted him, they found him all of the marvelous things they could. They could instantly assume any color they wanted. They could produce any sound or voice at all. And third, they could obtain instantly any pleasurable feeling they wanted. To test them, Aniruddha mentally wished that they would become blue, so they became blue. As he could read, they could read his thoughts. When he wished them to change to other colors, they would do that too. Now these female deities thought that Aniruddha was pleased with their presence, and they started to sing and dance very beautifully, but the venerable Aniruddha turned his senses away from them. When the deities noticed that Aniruddha did not find pleasure in their performance, they instantly left. If we remember how Aniruddha had spent his youth as a prince, enchanted by arts and music, we may understand better how this scene could still belong to him. Had he not listened to the Buddha's words, he might quite possibly have taken rebirth among these deities who were superior in rank to the gods of the 33s. Aniruddha must have thought this experience worth telling, for when he saw the Buddha in the evening, he recounted it to him. He then raised the question, what attributes should a woman have to be reborn in the realm of these graceful spirits? Graceful spirits, I think, are... they're still devas, but I think... they're considered to be in the realm of manifesting, if I'm not mistaken. That would be the fifth Devaloka. The sixth Devaloka is where they don't even have to manifest anything anymore. They just take whatever is manifested. His thirst for knowledge made him wish to know the moral level of these deities. The Buddha replied willingly and said that 8 qualities were needed in order to be reborn in that realm. First, the wife has to show willingness and friendliness towards her husband. Second, she should be courteous and hospitable towards people her husband holds dear, such as his parents and certain ascetics and priests. Third, she should do her housework carefully and with diligence. Fourth, she was to care for and guide the employees in a purposeful manner. Fifth, she should not squander her husband's possessions, but should guard them well. Sixth, she should not be given to alcoholic drink and should not be a cause for her husband's ruin. Seventh, as a lay follower, she should take refuge in the Triple Gem and should observe the 5 moral precepts. And last, she should find joy in sharing and being generous in giving, showing concern for those in need. Well, on both these occasion, female deities materialized before Aniruddha. There are other reports in which Aniruddha directed the power of his divine eye to understand how women are born in heaven or in hell. He also once asked the Buddha which qualities led to a woman to a hellish world, and he was told that there were 5 qualities: lack of spiritual faith, lack of shame and moral scruples, anger, lack of wisdom, further such qualities as revengefulness, jealousy, avarice, committing adultery, immorality, sloth, and lack of mindfulness would also lead to rebirth in hell. Only those with the opposite qualities would be reborn in the heavenly realm. Another time, Aniruddha reported to the Buddha that he had often seen how women after her death was reborn in the lower world, even in hell. The Buddha replied that there are three harmful qualities which will lead a woman to hell. If in the morning she is full of avarice, at noon full of envy, and in the evening obsessed of full of sensual desire. Reports of Aniruddha's past lives also refer to his relation to women. There is only one instance that mentions his rebirth as an animal. Once when he was reborn as a wood pigeon, his mate was seized by a hawk, tormented by passion and grief. He decided to fast until he had overcome his love for her and the grief of separation. Another rebirth story tells of the following. Once when Aniruddha was born as a king, he saw a lovely fairy woman in the forest, fell in love with her, and shot at her husband in order to possess her. Full of pain and sorrow, she cried out and denounced the king's cruelty. Hearing her accusation, the king sobered up and went his way. At that time, Aniruddha was the king. Yasodhara was the fairy woman. Yasodhara was the Buddha's wife before he became the Buddha. And her husband was the Bodhisattva, who was now Aniruddha's master, and whom in that past life he had almost killed out of lust for a woman. In divine form of existence as Sakya, king of the gods, he helped the Bodhisattva to regain his reputation when he was the famous magician Gutilla. As a test, three times he made appear on earth 300 celestial maidens who danced when Gutilla played his lute. When Sakya invited Gutilla into the heavenly world at the request of the heavenly nymphs who wanted to hear his music, after he had played to them, he asked them to tell him which good deeds had brought them to the heavenly world. They told him that in the past they had given small gifts to monks, heard their discourses, shared what they had with others, and were without anger and pride. Hearing this, the Bodhisattva rejoiced in the benefit he had thus gained in his visit to Sakya's heaven. In Aniruddha's life as a monk, there was one incident which led to the propagation of a disciplinary rule for the Buddha. Aniruddha and his brother Ananda were the only ones among the close circle of the Buddha's disciples who occasioned the setting forth of a Vinaya rule. In both cases, it concerned women. Once the venerable Aniruddha was wandering through the kingdom of Kosala towards Savati. In the evening, he reached a village and found that there was no place in where wandering ascetics and monks could stay. At the village inn, which was managed by a woman, he asked for a night's lodging, and this was granted. Meanwhile, more travelers began to arrive in the inn to stay for the night. And the dormitory where Aniruddha was to stay became crowded. The inn hostess, seeing this, told the venerable Aniruddha that she would prepare his bedding in an inside room where he could spend the night peacefully. Silently, Aniruddha agreed. She, however, had made this suggestion only because she had fallen in love with him. She now perfumed herself, put on her jewelry, and thus approached Aniruddha, saying, "You, respected sir, are handsome. You are graceful and good-looking. And so am I. It will be good if the respected sir will take me as his wife." Aniruddha, however, remained silent. Then the inn hostess offered him all her riches. Aniruddha still remained silent. When the woman took off her upper garment and danced in front of him, sat down, lay down in front of him, but Aniruddha had his senses well under control and paid no attention to her. Seeing that none of her allurements moved him, she explained, "Astonishing it is, dear sir, extraordinary. So many men have offered me hundreds and thousands to win me. But this ascetic whom I myself have asked does not desire my wealth or me." The woman then put on her upper garment and again fell at Aniruddha's feet, asking for forgiveness for having tried to seduce the venerable ascetic. He now opened his mouth for the first time to pardon her, exhorting her to grant herself in the future, or to guard herself in the future. She then left. On the next morning, she brought him his breakfast as if nothing had happened. Aniruddha then proceeded to give a talk on the Dhamma, which so touched her that she became a devout lay follower of the Buddha. Aniruddha, however, continued his journey, and when he reached the monastery at Sawatthi, he told the monks about his adventure. The Buddha called him and reproached him for having spent the night in a woman's quarters. He then proclaimed a rule which prohibited this, Vinaya Sutta Vibhanga Pachetya. This story shows well the Venerable Aniruddha's self-restraint, which had saved him from becoming a slave to sense impressions. His strength of character had made such a deep impression on that woman that she repented, listened to him, and took refuge in the Buddha. Thus Aniruddha's self-control was not only for his own good, but also brought benefit to the woman. But when the Buddha yet reprimanded him, he did so because weaker characters could well succumb to temptation in such situations. Hence, out of compassion for them, the Buddha prescribed the rule that a monk should not expose himself to such dangers. Frequently, he should observe that the Buddha wanted to prevent weaker characters from overrating their strength and trying to emulate an ideal too high for them. This story closely parallels a similar experience which befell Saint Bernard of Clairvaux, whatever, who resembles Aniruddha in his strength of will. One day, as a young monk, Bernard came to an inn and asked for a lodging for the night. He was offered a bench in the public room, as there was no other place available. The innkeeper's daughter had fallen in love with him, with that handsome young monk, and went to him during the night. He, however, turned to the wall and drew his cape up and said to her, If you're looking for a place to sleep, there is room enough." This total disinterest in her person sobered her, and she slinked away ashamed. Like Aniruddha, he too had mastered the situation, not through arguments, but simply through the strength of his purity. Once the court carpenter Panchakanga, by name, invited Venerable Aniruddha for an alms meal. From other texts we know that Panchakanga was a person well-versed in the Dhamma and devoted to the practice. So after the meal, he asked a rather subtle question from the Venerable Aniruddha. He said that some monks had advised him to practice the measureless liberation of mind, and others recommended the exalted liberation of mind. He wanted to know whether these two were different or one and the same. The immeasurable or measureless liberation of mind is the Brahma-viharas. The exalted liberation of mind is the arupa-jhanas. So this is really sneaky, because you have some of the arupa-jhanas with the Brahma-viharas. Aniruddha replied that these two meditations are different. The measureless liberation of mind is the cultivation of loving-kindness, compassion, altruistic joy, and equanimity. But the exalted liberation of mind is the meditative practice of widening the inner perception from limited extent to a vast ocean-like extent. After giving his instructions to Panchakanga, Aniruddha spoke of a class of deities, the radiant gods. I think this is the radiant gods are the mastery of the first jhana, and said that although they all belong to the same order of celestial beings, there are differences among them in their radiance, which may be limited or measureless, pure or not quite pure. He explained that these divergences are due to the different quality of meditation that had caused their rebirth in that world. On being questioned by a monk, Aniruddha confirmed that his ultimate knowledge about these deities derived from his own experience, saying that he had previously lived with them and conversed with them. There is yet another scene in which Aniruddha figures. Once the Buddha was sitting in the open, surrounded by many monks whom he was teaching. On that occasion, he asked the Venerable Aniruddha whether they were all contented in leading the ascetic life. When Aniruddha confirmed this, the Buddha praised such contentment and said, "Those who have left the home life while still young, becoming monks in their prime of life, did not do so fearing punishment by kings or being motivated by loss of property, by debts, worries, or poverty. Rather, they took to the ascetic life out of faith in the Dhamma and inspired by the goal of liberation. What should such a one do if he was not yet gained the peace and happiness of the meditative jhanas or something higher? Then he should strive to get rid of the five mental hindrances and other defilements of mind so that he may achieve the bliss of meditation or a peace that is still higher." In concluding his discourse, the Buddha said that when he declares the attainment and future destiny of disciples who have died, he does so to inspire others to emulate their example. These words of the Blessed One gave much contentment and joy to the Venerable Aniruddha. Once one of the Brahma gods conceived the idea that no ascetic would be able to penetrate to the heights of the Brahma world. The Brahma world is the second jhana. When the Buddha perceived in his mind the thoughts of that deity, he appeared before him in a blaze of light. Four of his great disciples, the Venerable Mahamoggallana, Mahakasapa, Mahakapina, and Aniruddha, considered at the time where the Blessed One might be then dwelling, and with their divine eyes they saw that they saw him seated in the Brahma world. Then by their supernormal power, they too appeared in the heavenly world and sat down at a respectful distance from the Buddha. Seeing this, the deity was cured of his pride and acknowledged the superior power of the Buddha and his disciples. Another time, the Venerable Aniruddha had woken up in the middle of the night and recited verses of Dhamma until the dawn broke. A female spirit with her small son was listening devoutly to the recitation, and she told her son he should be very quiet. It may be if we understand the holy words and live accordingly that it will be a great blessing for us and may free us from rebirth in the lower spiritual realms. At that time, when there was a quarrel between two groups of monks in Kosambi, the Venerable Ananda went to see the Buddha, who asked him whether that quarrel had been settled. Ananda had to tell him that the quarrel still continued. A pupil of his brother, Aniruddha, insisted on creating disharmony in the Sangha, and to this the Venerable Aniruddha did not say a word. This happened at a time while Aniruddha, together with Nandiya and Kambila, had gone to the Gosinga forest to devote themselves to a strictly meditative life. Ananda's criticism was that Aniruddha had taken on pupils and then did nothing to guide them when there was still discourse among them. The Buddha, however, came to Aniruddha's defense, saying that there was no need for Aniruddha to concern himself with that. There are others like Ananda himself, Sariputta or Mahamoggallana, who are quite capable of dealing with such disputes. Besides, there are incorrigible monks who are quite pleased when others quarrel, as this would divert attention from their own bad conduct, and thus they would avoid being sent away. An example of this is a story of two conceited monks who tried to outdo each other in disputations. One of them was a pupil of Ananda, of whom we know how carefully he concerned himself with the affairs of the Sangha. The other monk was a pupil of Aniruddha, who, as we saw above, had a more detached attitude. Those two vainglorious monks just acted according to their character, though they had different teachers to guide them. Of Aniruddha's earlier lives, we have several stories handed down to us, especially in the Jataka tales, the birth stories. Once, when he was a poor man, he made a gift to an ascetic. At the time of the Buddha Kassapa, he had honored his grave by lighting butter lamps. Aniruddha said of himself, "I know my former lives and where and how I lived in years gone by. Among the gods, 33, I stood of Sakha's rank. Seven times a king I held my sway, lord of the earth from end to end, four square. I have no idea what that means. A conqueror of India, using no force or arms. I ruled by right. That means he was a universal monarch. Hence, seven and other seven lifespans of life, even 14 former births I recognize. Even then, when the world of the gods, with the world of the gods reborn. In the Jataka tales, there are no less than 23 accounts telling of Aniruddha's earlier lives. In most cases, he was Saka, king of the gods. Once he was Saka's messenger, a deity called Panjasika, who was a celestial musician. In the seven worldly lives that are mentioned, he was most often an ascetic, and he was twice the brother of the Bodhisattva. In three other lives, he was human reborn as he was a king, a court priest, and a court charioteer. Only once his rebirth as an animal is reported, namely as an amorous wood pigeon mentioned above. As far as is recorded in the Jatakas, he was 15 times a deity, 7 times a human being, and once an animal. The fact that he was so often a king, celestial or human, indicates the power and strength in his nature. When he was quite a different god king than Zeus, with the amorous liaisons, and differed also from Jehovah, who often inflicted harsh punishment on people. As Saka, king of the gods, 33 gods, he was rather one who always protected and helped. When the Bodhisattva was in need of help, he came to his help. He protected him from being executed when he was defamed. On that occasion, the Bodhisattva's wife had raised her voice to heaven, to high heaven, over the injustice. Moved by her entry, Saka, the future Aniruddha, took action and saved the Bodhisattva. When the Bodhisattva was king, he had forbidden animal sacrifices in his kingdom. A bloodthirsty demon resented this and went to kill the king, but Saka appeared and protected the Bodhisattva again. In other such cases, Saka wanted to put the Bodhisattva to a test in order to strengthen his virtue. So in the last of the Jataka tales, in the guise of an old Brahmin, he asked the Bodhisattva for his wife in order to test his joyful generosity. The last Jataka tale is all about the perfection of generosity. And the Buddha, or the Bodhisattva, he started out as a king, and he had a white elephant. And other people would come around and say, "Oh, I want some of this, I want some of that." He just started giving everything away. And he ticked off the lower dignitaries when he gave away the white elephant, because the white elephant was such a lucky elephant that whenever you wanted rain, all you had to do was go tell the elephant and it would rain. And he gave it away, and when he gave it away, then they said, "You can't be king anymore. Get out of here, boy." So he took his son and his daughter and his wife, and as he was going to become a hermit, then he met this this old hermit, and the old Brahmin asked him for his wife, and he said, "Okay, you can have my wife." And it was a test and resolve to see whether his generosity was truly an act of joy, or he was doing it like spontaneously or not. And it turned out that he was. He went on a little bit further, and his son and his daughter, Sokka came down and did that number again and asked for the son and daughter. And he really loved his son and daughter a lot, but he gave them up joyfully. And the Brahmin took the son and daughter, and they went someplace, and they escaped and came back to the Bodhisattva. And the Brahmin came back and said, "Have you seen those two children?" And he said, "Yes, they're right here." And he gave them back, and they were crying and weeping as they were going away. And the Bodhisattva still had joy. He still had an uplifted mind. So they figured, well, okay, we've tested enough. So they brought back the wife and the kids and gave them back to him and said that it was a test. When the Bodhisattva was leading a life of an ascetic, Sokka wanted to test his patience and forbearance and blame for his physical ugliness. Bodhisattva told him of his ugly deed that had been made him so ugly, and he praised the goodness and purity for which he was now striving. Then Sokka said that he would grant him a wish. What the Bodhisattva asked for was freedom from malice, hatred, greed, and lust. Further, he wished that he might never hurt anyone ever again. All of that was explained. After all of that was explained, it was not in Sokka's power to grant that wish, but this has come from his own moral effort. Sokka also tested the Bodhisattva's frugality. In the third group of accounts, Sokka invited the Bodhisattva to his heaven and showed him the mysteries of the celestial and the hell worlds. This was told in a story of the musician Gutilla, which we have already accounted. In the stories of King Numi and the charitable King Sabdhina, Sokka also invited them to his heaven. From his lives as a human being, the following episode had been chosen. When Anuruddha was a court Brahmin and counselor, the king asked him how advantageous and actions and justice could be united by one who was a ruler. Without intellectual pride, the Brahmin admitted that he could not answer that question. Instead, he went assiduously in search of one he knew. He found him in the Bodhisattva. When he was a royal charioteer, he once wanted to avoid a heavy downpour, which was threatening. To speed up the horses, he hit them with a goat. From that time on, however, the horses came to that particular spot in the road, and they started to gallop as if they were in danger lurking near them. Seeing this, the charioteer regretted deeply that he had frightened and hurt those noble steeds, and he admitted that by having done so, he did not fully observe the traditional Kuru virtues. That's a five virtues, but really strict. All these diverse and colorful stories have a common feature. They show several characteristic qualities of Anuruddha: his strong, active striving for virtue, his strength of character, as well as his concern for the welfare of others. He also showed that his skill in meditation and his mastery of supernormal faculties had their roots in his experiences during many lives as Sakya, king of the ruler of the gods. The venerable Aniruddha was present in the last hours before the Buddha's decease, recounted in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. When the master knew that death was close, he entered into full sequence of the meditative jhanas on the fine material realm and immaterial realm, and then he entered in the state of the cessation of perception and feeling. At that moment, Ananda turned to his brother, the Venerable Aniruddha, saying, Venerable Aniruddha, the Blessed One has passed away. But Aniruddha, as an arahat endowed with the divine eye, had been able to gauge the level of meditation into which the Buddha had entered, and said, Not so, friend Ananda. The Blessed One has not passed away. He has entered the state of the cessation of perception and feeling. The Buddha, however, rising from that attainment of cessation, turned his mind back to the stages of immaterial absorption in their reverse order until he reached the first jhana. Then he rose up again to the fourth fine material jhana, and rising from it, he instantly passed away into the Nibbana element, which is without any remainder of the aggregates of existence. When the enlightened one had finally passed away, Brahma, the high deity, and Sakya, the king of the 33 gods, honored the Buddha in verses invoking law of impermanence. The third to speak was Aniruddha, who uttered these verses. No movement of the breath, but with steadfast heart, desireless and tranquil, comes the sage to his end. With heart unshaken by any painful feeling, like a flame extinguished, found his mind released. Many of the monks attending the Buddha's last hour grieved and lamented over the over the master's death. But Aniruddha exhorted them and told them that many deities were also present. Among them too were those who lamented and others who contained their grief. But had not the master always taught them the impermanence of all? And so just that had happened. The Venerable Ananda and the Venerable Aniruddha and the Venerable Ananda spent the rest of the night near the deceased master. In the morning, Aniruddha asked Ananda to announce the passing of the Blessed One to the householders living in the next village, Kusinara. At once they gathered and prepared a funeral pyre. When, however, eight strong men tried to lift the body to the pyre, they could not do so. They then went to the Venerable Aniruddha and asked for the reason why the body could not be moved. Aniruddha told them that the deities wanted a different ceremony and explained it to them, whereupon all happened just as intended by the deities. With regard to the procedure of burning the body, the householder turned to the Venerable Ananda for advice. This shows the different competence of the two brothers. Aniruddha was master of otherworldly affairs, while Ananda was well-versed in the matters concerning the worldly life. After the Buddha's demise, the guidance of the order did not go to his next of kin, as, for instance, the arahat Aniruddha. The Buddha did not nominate any formal successor, but the natural veneration of the monks and lay people concentrated on the Venerable Mahakasapa. It was he who initiated the first council at which 500 Arahat monks took part in establishing a final text of the Buddha's teaching. Before the council opened, the Venerable Ananda had not yet attained Arahatship, and this would have excluded him from participating in the council. It was his brother Aniruddha who urged him to make determined effort to break through the last fetters and realize final liberation. Within a short time, Aniruddha succeeded, and so, as an Arahat, could join the other Arahats in the council. During its session, he recited the numerous teachings which he, of all monks, had heard best, retained in his memory. In this matter, Aniruddha had helped his brother to attain the goal of liberation for the good of the Sangha and for the good of all seekers looking for a way out of existential dilemma. And this has remained a blessing to us even today. Aniruddha himself was entrusted at the council with the preservation of the Anguttara Nikaya, according to commentary in the Digha Nikaya. About the Venerable Aniruddha's death, nothing else is known except the serene last stanza of his 20 verses in the Songs of the Elders. The Buddha was my fealty and love, and all the Buddha's ordinance is done. Lo, have I had the heavy load I bore. Cause for rebirth is found in me no more. In Valuva, in Vajrayana land, it will be that life will reach its final term for me, and I beneath bamboo thickets shade that day, free from all taints, shall wholly pass away. What happened was, after the Third Buddhist Council, or this is what they decided at the Third Buddhist Council, was that one monk that was very well versed would take one of the Nikayas, and there was four monks. But Ananda, he had all of them, so he could use them anytime he wanted. And this is where they decided that Ananda kind of made a mistake when the Buddha was dying. And Ananda asked if any of the rules of the monks should be changed. And the Buddha said, you can change the minor rules. But Ananda didn't ask him which rules were minor and which rules were not. So when they got to the first Buddhist council, they couldn't decide, so they kept all the rules. So
there's never been any consensus on what was minor or not.
Well, not really. But monks, if a sangha of senior monks comes together and they decide for their monastery that they're staying at that some of the, there's really picayune-ish kinds of rules. You notice we all have our shoes off here. One of the rules is, if you have your shoes on, I can't give a Dhamma talk. Now, in some monasteries, the places that they gave Dhamma talks was outside, and they allowed people to keep their shoes on. So the Sangha members would come together and say, we're going to let that rule go for this monastery. And that's how some of the things got changed around. But when the Mahayana went into China, they started adding a lot of rules. And one of the rules they added was that you're supposed to be a vegetarian. And that's definitely not a rule that the Buddha was interested in keeping. But they had other minor rules, but they don't really follow them very closely. Eating afternoon, they all eat, have evening meals and that sort of thing. It's kind of shocking to be around.
Tibetans do that.
Yeah. When I went to Hawaii, when I was there with Kamala in the 70s, can't think of his name. Very famous monk. No, this was a Tibetan monk. Okay, he was going to be giving a talk, 7 o'clock. So at 7 o'clock, I showed up at this Buddhist church. No. I'll remember it before long. Anyway, the monks weren't there. And I'm thinking, you know, this is really strange. But this is Tibetan, and they're kind of weird, so we'll just wait a little while. And they came 15, 20 minutes late. Walked in, said, "Sorry, folks, we were having dinner up here at this fancy restaurant, and it took longer to eat than we thought it would." Then they got on their Tibetan horns and started blowing and all of that sort of thing. But I was, you know, I'd spent time at Still Point for a year and a half with Manindra and all these, knowing about all these monks and, yeah, you'd never eat after 12 o'clock and all of this. And then have these monks just openly talk, "Oh, it was a great meal." Wait a minute. It caused some doubt to arise, let's put it that way. Well, I've been to monasteries that there were some alcoholic monks, and there were also some monks that had taken, they were into heroin. And they got busted. I mean, what a scandal that was. So... No, other than, I'll leave it at that. But it was really a major scandal when they found out about it. Anyway. Of all the Nikayas, if you can compare one Nikaya to the other, the Anguttara Nikaya is probably the deepest. A lot of the Abhidhamma came from the Anguttara Nikaya. Let's share some merit. May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear-struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we've thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas of mighty power, share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddhist dispensations.